Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Fandamentals podcast. I am your host, Harley. Joining me on this episode for the first time ever, it's not one, but two guests. I am joined by both Tom Wheatley and Brendan Duffy from the James Bond A to Z podcast. And their chosen topic, well, you guessed it, it's James Bond. Yes, that's right, I sit down with two guests to discuss one of the most iconic characters in all of cinema. We talk about the legacy of Bond, how he's managed to endure over 60 years of cinema, the various iterations of the character, what's changed over the years, what hasn't or perhaps should be changed, and so much more. It's really a fascinating conversation that dissects one of the most influential things, arguably, in all of pop culture. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to both of these guys, and I cannot wait for you guys to hear this episode. So, without further ado, let's just get straight into it. This is James Bond with Tom Wheatley and Brendan Duffy. Hello, and welcome to both Tom and Brendan on the Fandamentals podcast.
Hello.
Hello there.
This is really cool. This is the first time I've ever had more than one guest on, and both of you guys are here for the one subject, and that is James Bond. So I thought to kind of kick it off, I'd love to know from you guys, when was the first time you guys were introduced to the cinematic legend?
Go on, Brendan.
Well, when I was growing up, when I was significantly younger, you know, there wasn't a Bond. I was sort of growing up during that hiatus of between Dalton and Brosnan, so GoldenEye was very much imprinted on my mind as the first that I was aware of and the first time I got into Bond. And then I recall watching Tomorrow Never Dies at the cinema. And then it just snowballs from there, really.
Wow. Okay. And how about yourself, Tom?
Mine's very different. My dad has... He's not, like, obsessed with Bond, but he's always liked it. So I don't remember a time where I got into Bond. I think I probably saw my first Bond when I was about three or something. It was on in the room. So it was just a very natural adoption of Bond into my life. I never really just suddenly thought, oh, I like this. It's just always there.
I got to say, yeah, when you're living in the British Isles over here, you do sort of, I feel like that's the more common introduction, is it's just on.
Yeah.
It's just something that's always on in the background. You go, what's this? And your parents go, oh, yeah, this is Thunderball or Dr. No. Sit down and watch it. And you're like, what is this world? And I mean, it's one of those things I think to the outside world is quite fascinating because it feels like pretty much our Star Wars in a way, isn't it? It's like our huge movie franchise from the UK that we just push into the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Carry On films never quite hit those peaks, did they?
No, and probably for the best. I mean, actually, saying that, you've got Austin Powers, I suppose, that's in that vein.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mix, isn't it?
That's not really us either, though, is it? That's more of a... What is he, Canadian?
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. But no, yeah, Bond's one of those, I think, it's just... It's a fascinating character. And you guys run a show that you're going through all of them. You're going from the A to Z, aren't you, of Bond, which tells you there's so much to get into.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're not just talking about the films and the main characters. We're talking about everyone. Like, quite often, the other Tom, he sort of organises the plan of what we're going to talk through. And he's probably... He's more like your encyclopedia of Bond. Like he just digests Bond information and he knows, you know, he'll sit and look at the credits roll and he'll know all the people in it. But he'll sort of send us across this list of, right, these are the ones we're doing next week. And more often than not, I've got no idea who, like, most of them are. because he's picking cinematographers, producers, things like that that I just didn't know about until now, which is, it's nice because... I'm learning about these things as I go along, whereas I think Butler just knows all of these things. Already.
Yeah, I kind of feel like it's a massive jigsaw, a really massive jigsaw that we're filling in piece by piece, and that we're already getting a lot of overlap. So we'll come to a film, we'll go, oh, we know that director, we know the cinematographer. Okay, we get this, we get the story of it. So by the time we get to Z, I assume we'll just go, yep, you know it. And then they're just
I think what will happen is we'll get to the end and we'll realise that everything we did up until like the last few episodes is utter nonsense because we didn't know everything. We'll just delete it and start again and do it properly.
Brilliant. So I'm curious from your own personal journeys then, because Brendan, I think yours is quite similar to mine. I remember sort of growing up seeing a couple of movies and then it was kind of the Brosnan era was like in the cinemas. And I think the first film I ever saw was it Die Another Day? The one with the ice and driving on, there's an invisible car.
Yeah, that's Die Another Day. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for you then, you watched Tomorrow Never Dies? I mean, you can see the similarities already in these in these movies, but was that like a moment for you? You kind of went, okay, I want to know more about this character.
The moment was filled in by those Sunday afternoons that Wheatley talks of. So like the introduction was Brosnan, and then it's like, oh, where can I get more of this? Where can I see more of this character? And luckily, at the time, Brosnan's films were being churned out. There was only 2 years between the first three had only had 2 years gaps, which meant you didn't have to wait long before it was in the cinema again. But then, and obviously the classics being on the TV, so you can dip in. When you're younger, you tend to find older films boring because of the pacing, I would say. It takes you to get to a certain age to really enjoy the pacing of From Russia with Love. As a 12, 13-year-old, I'm not going to be into that. I'd rather see Pierce Brosnan in CGI ice. Would I? Maybe.
You're not a very cultured man, are you?
I was 12, 13. That is,
we're going to start one of these arguments again now.
Yeah, and I'll leave it in. That's the best part.
I always think it's a tricky one for... I think modern-day Bond fans have got a bit of a tough ride, really, because if you didn't grow up to an extent where you... Maybe not Sean Connery, but definitely Roger Moore. If you watch... definitely a Daniel Craig film and you think, I love this character, I love this story, I'm going to delve back into the past of this character, and you start watching Moonraker, you're going to think, actually, I've made a mistake. I don't like this character anymore. And it's not like, I'm a big fan of old films. I love Hitchcock's and old Howard Hughes films and stuff like that. And those films, you look back on them and they are still classics. There's a reason why people still watch those films, because they are brilliant and they're perfectly made, and there's a reason they stood the test of time. But the reason that like Roger Moore Bond films have stood the test of time is because they're part of this Bond series. And if the Sean Connery films, I'd probably class them closer to the Hitchcock side of things, where there are a lot of classics in there that have shaped the movies. But the Roger Moore ones, if you didn't have the Sean Connery ones and you didn't have the Brosnan ones, I don't think people would probably remember those films, and I don't think they'd go back to them. So I think for modern day Bond new fans, and maybe somebody who's just watched No Time to Die for the first time, who's quite young, and said, this is brilliant, I love it, they're not going to go back and go, oh, Roger Moore, exactly what I expected it to be.
Okay, so you think there's like an element of nostalgia then, really, that's kind of fuels an interest in it?
Yeah, I think I'd be interested to see... our era of Bond fans, so I'm nearly 40 now, it's always gone hand in hand. So at that time when I was a kid, the Connery films were still, they weren't really old at that time. People were still watching them, and they were still shown on like Christmas Day as like a big film that was being shown. Now they're not. Now they're nobody, you know, on ITV3 like every night or whatever. But I think there's a certain... Having grown up with them at the same time as the new ones were being released, I think made it easier to become really involved with the whole Bond saga. So if you're watching the Brosnan films, but you already like you're still seeing those Bond films that are coming on at weekends, you can understand the whole saga a bit better. But yeah, I think there's definitely a big leap for young fans to get back into the whole of the Bond series.
Right. Okay. I'm just thinking about it then. I mean, I guess that's one advantage, though, in a way, isn't it, perhaps, is that as everyone who knows Bond knows that there are different eras, because, yeah, each actor kind of brings their own take on the character and they get their own story. So I guess when you're looking at a series that's, it's 25 movies now, isn't it? I think you can forgive one or two for perhaps not being as good as another. I don't know. Maybe I'm being a bit
just
optimistic.
One or two.
It's a lot more. It's a lot more than just one or two. But
I'll throw my hands up and say I haven't seen all of them. But
yeah, I mean, anything that lasts for that long, spanning 60 years. If all 25 of them were 10 out of 10s, I mean, that'd just be, it's not reachable, is it? It's not realistic. And even within those films that we don't particularly, you know, like as a whole, there's always good set pieces. And you can rarely fault the actor playing Bond either, really. To be fair, I'm no fan of Roger Moore's Bond, but you can't fault Roger Moore himself. He is playing his version of Bond and he does it very well. The scripts sometimes tend to let him down and the silliness got out of hand, but that era was necessary to transition from the 60s to get him through. Maybe he shouldn't have stayed on till the mid 80s, but to get him through to that next era, it's an important role that each Bond has played.
Yeah.
So that end, then, do you guys have a favourite Bond?
Yeah, Brendan does, who he talks about all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mine's easy. Mine's Pierce Brosnan, and that's probably because he was my Bond growing up. But I also think he does embody the personality of Bond perfectly, and the attitude and the look and the style. I'm not saying he's the best, but he's my favourite. There's no point in having a conversation who's the best. We all know who's the best.
Connery, best by far. Well, I've had a view on Bond that my favourite has changed quite a bit over time. I used to think Roger Moore was the best one. At a point, I thought Dalton was the best one. Having rewatched a lot of the films and discussed them, it's just every time Connery just comes up as like the perfect, a great actor. The best films from the point of view of script writing and how they're all pulled together. And yeah, just he shaped Bond, basically. No one else really shaped Bond the way that he did.
Yeah, that's true. I always thought that must be quite a difficult thing for an actor to do, to approach something, you know, post Connery. And obviously Connery had an advantage of being like one of the first, so he could kind of really mark his stamp on it. And it's so iconic. Like, it's true, whenever you think of Bond, if you do the impression, most people do a pretty poor Sean Connery, because that's the first thing that comes to your head. So I've always thought for actors it must be tricky approaching that role of, A, it's a huge character in cinema, and B, like, there's somebody who's already done such an iconic series of movies.
Yeah, it's the most stressful job in the acting world, becoming Bond. That's why so many people just, you see it with every single Bond actor, apart from Roger Moore. I don't think Roger Moore ever disliked being Bond, but obviously Craig, he wanted to quit like twice when he was working on his series, just because the stress of it and the expectations of doing those films are just too much. And Connery, I mean, he mirrors Craig in that he just didn't want to be involved in it from, what was it, You Only Live Twice? Yeah. He pretty much had enough. Mm. And he left. And then came back for Die Another Day. Die Another Day. Diamonds Are Forever. Imagine. And he left and came back. But I think the problem with Bond is that there aren't many roles for actors where people don't care about you. They only care about the character. So when an actor who's playing Bond's walking around the street or appearing on TV, people expect them to be Bond. They think it's Bond. They don't really care about the actor. They care about the Bond character. So people would ask you for autographs from James Bond and all this sort of stuff. And for an actor, and especially people like Connery and Craig, who were very, very, or are very keen on the craft and being proper actors. Roger Moore, again, probably didn't mind very much. I don't think he ever argued about it at all. But certainly for those, it's a very difficult role to have, because you can't really, you're stuck to this character. You can't do anything else. So I think it probably is the most stressful job for an actor to have, and that's why it's such a difficult decision for when they get the new ones in.
So what do you guys think makes a good Bond then, versus a bad one perhaps?
It's all the ingredients coming together, which we've spoken about many times on the podcast. Goldfinger is where the ingredients come together perfectly. You've got a plot that is simple enough to understand and explain. You can explain the plot of Goldfinger in 3 or 4 sentences. It's got the music. It's got the right Bond at the right time. It's got and the evil henchman, iconic. And not too long, not overly long as well, just nice and compact. I think.
Yeah, the Goldfinger definitely always comes down as the sort of perfect Bond film for us. But if you're talking about the perfect Bond as in a who plays Bond, who gets that role, I think it's very much based on the time and place when the films are set. There's no such thing as a perfect Bond across the whole series because Dalton was the wrong Bond at that time, but he would have been a very good Bond nowadays. He would have been almost identical to Craig's style of Bond, but at that time it just didn't work. And it's the same with the early ones as well. Like Roger Moore, he works at that time. That's what movies were like at that time. That's what people wanted. No, if you release a Sean Connery sort of spy thriller in the late 70s and early 80s, people wouldn't have watched it. They wanted stupid things where, you know, Bond's going into space and he's dressing up as a clown. That's exactly what those time periods are like. So I think you can have a perfect Bond in the way that they kind of tick off a lot of aspects of the character, but it is always entirely down to the world in which the Bond is placed. And you'll see that with the next Bond that comes out, very unlikely that they're going to be like Daniel Craig. They'll probably be changed to something very different.
Yeah, I've always thought that must be something that makes the character so enduring. As you guys have pointed out, it's been over 60 years. Like, how does a character who essentially you could sum up in a sentence, what is it, he's a spy that goes around the world beating bad guys, how do you keep that interesting over several decades? And I think, Tom, you've just summed it up quite nicely. It's you make him relevant.
Yeah.
You sort of change him and he's quite malleable in that way, which is really, I think it's really interesting. I mean, to your point, I've always found it funny that the transition between sort of Pierce Brosnan and then Daniel Craig, it's almost night and day in terms of how the characters behave.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have commented that, you know, well, yeah, because it's a response to like the Jason Bourne type, you know, more hardcore action films. And the opening to Casino Royale very much is that statement, isn't it? You're like, oh, okay, this guy's just brutal. He's a sledgehammer. Yeah. Right, okay, this is the Bond we've got for the next, you know, 10 years plus.
Well, that's a testament to, I always think that the Bond series, it's not really about a character and it's not really about a storyline for that people are following. It's just a concept. I mean, it might as well just be called Suave Spy and then you can do whatever you want. And that's how it works. So if you were to do Indiana Jones, if you were to continue doing the Indiana Jones films for ages, it won't work because you're stuck in that character and you're stuck in that storyline. And the last film pretty much proved that he was too old for it. It just wasn't, it didn't work anymore because you were stuck to the character. You weren't, the concept is great. And an archaeologist who travels around the world doing cool things and finding this stuff. But when it's the same character and you're stuck with all of the historical baggage that this character's got, it becomes a very, very difficult process to kind of cover. And the way that they solve that in films like Indiana Jones is, or they're trying to solve it, is by having somebody take over from him. But that's still the same story, and it's still trying to continue this thing through all these different ages where the world has changed. Whereas Bond, it's not about a man. It's the man is irrelevant. He's not got that. One of the biggest discussions we have and arguments we have is about the sort of the way that Bond, you don't want to know about his origins. You don't want to know about his family. You don't want to know about his hopes and dreams. He's just a man that sits in this point in time and you're just watching him. And every time they do go towards his origins and stuff, it doesn't work so well. And it kind of loses the audience because it doesn't matter. It's just, it's a concept. He's not a man you care about.
Interesting. In fact, that brings me back around to something that you said a minute ago, Brendan, that I thought was quite interesting about this idea of bringing together all these ingredients to make a Bond film. And I think that kind of ties in quite nicely with what you just said there, Tom, that, yeah, it's not so much about the guy, it's more about the situation, it's more about all the other stuff that comes with a Bond film, because I don't know about you guys. I remember going to one down in Australia when I think Skyfall came out, and it was like a sort of mini premiere. And I was just amazed at how much of an event it is, even like halfway around the world, because I think that's probably why, right? It's because there's so much that comes with Bond. It's not just the character. There's usually elements of where he is, of, you know, the music, the stunts. There's so much that goes into it. So yeah, I mean, talk to me about that.
What do you think, Brendan?
The thing that separates the Bond films and that keeps it special is they're always trying to one up their last, you know, with the stunts, with the special effects. And when they get it right, it is incredible. Like Skyfall, when they blow Skyfall up, that's amazing. That was done for real. Some great set pieces in Skyfall. We got the parkour in Casino Royale, but then when they don't do it right, so in Die Another Day, where it's just CGI, you lose the trust of the audience. But the audience, you know, that's what they want. They want these big set pieces, and they're excited by it, but they want to see what's happening next. No Time to Die was delayed for 2 years, and it kept the world waiting, going, they'd seen the trailers. We'd all seen the trailers, but we wanted more. We were like, we've seen what the trailer can do. Let's see what's in the actual film. It's just a package that people want more of. They seem to come back for more and more.
There's a fine line with Bond films, which is why they have stood the test of time for so long, in that it's very easy to get a production company loads of money and throw amazing set pieces and just throw ridiculous stunts and stuff at a film. You can see it all the time, and quite often those films don't work. Like, the stunts alone and the amazing set piece and stuff is not enough to make people love a film for ages. But the bonds that have worked best throughout the series are the ones that do this thing where they're showing you things that are amazing, but they're still attainable for everyone to understand. So all the places that he travels to, you can travel to those. It's not like, apart from the moon, but that's a Roger Moore thing. So, all those places that people that you see Bond travel to, they're things that you can do. They're not unattainable things. You can always go. You can always at the back of your head go, oh, I can do this. I can do these things. It's the same with the stuff that he does. Like, he's not Superman. You can watch it and go, oh, I could probably fight like that. Or you could go, I could drive a car like that. All these things, and it's a very nice balance in the Bond films that work, that engages the audience to the point where they feel like they could do it. So it's an attainable goal, and it's not like Marvel, or it's not like, I suppose even Bourne is a bit ridiculous because he's just too good. Whereas, you know, Craig, even though he's quite good at fighting and in his series of films, he's not flawless. He makes a lot of mistakes, and he's in some of them, he's an old man and he's struggling. And I think that's why it works, because you're following this character because you're invested in the fact that it isn't an unattainable goal.
Yeah, it's kind of like you reach the edge of fantasy, but you don't go over that line. Yeah. You stop.
And we're talking about Die Another Day, and that's where they've made the mistake and they've taken it too far, because most of the stuff in that film, you could never do. It could never happen. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. Mm. And then the audience just go, well, it's not interesting. That I've seen 1,000 films like this and I'm not engaged. But then you look at Goldfinger, he doesn't do anything in that film that a normal man couldn't do. So, and that's why it's so
drink some mint julep.
He does drink a lot of mint julep. Yeah.
You know, that's fascinating. I'd honestly never considered that angle before, but now that you say it, that's really true. Actually, I think the films that personally, I think, land better with me are where they feel that they're more grounded in reality. Even stuff down to like the gadgets, for instance. You know, I know you guys are fans of Skyfall, and that's quite a popular one. And I think that film made quite a conscious effort to ground that side of it. I remember watching the film and thinking, oh, he's literally given like a gun with a little handprint on it and a radio, and that's it. But to your point, it's attainable, and he uses them quite well, and it's sort of like it harkens back to some of those other eras where, yeah, okay, he's got a bulletproof car or something like that, but it's not completely outside of the world of belief. You're like, yeah, someone could conceivably build that. and it could work. And also, wouldn't it be kind of cool to drive one?
Yeah, well, look at most of the gadgets that they have in the Bond films. And within about 10 years, normally they exist because they're not sci-fi things. They're like, they've looked at the current trends and the current technology and gone, well, this isn't a leap. This is something that we could have. And you look, and some of the, like the you know, in Tomorrow Never Dies, he's got the little remote controlled car with the, that he's on a smartphone with. Back in those days, smartphones didn't really give you the ability to see nice video capture, and you couldn't control stuff from it. You could easily have a remote controlled car now. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah, Teslas are all remote controlled by you can use your phone. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
But you still couldn't paraglide off a cliff on a makeshift board on a tidal wave. That's not gonna wash.
With a giant CGI wave behind you. Yeah. Maybe not. But again, like you said, balance. That leads on to something else I find with the Bond franchise is there is also an element of aspiration. Because obviously he tends to move within the very high class part of society. The suits are a big thing. I didn't realize this until recently. I was listening to another podcast and they were talking about it. There's one guy in particular that really likes his suits and every time comments on the makes, and no doubt that person, whoever designs them, does very well because people go, oh, I like that. I'm going to go and get the Bond suit. And then there's the Bond watch. You know, I think, has it been Omega?
It's been pretty much always Omega, yeah. Years. I think Roger Moore had a Casio at one point, but it's pretty much always Omega.
Okay. Because, yeah, you see those advertised. And then, of course, we mentioned, you know, like the cars famously, like the Aston Martins and things like that. So I feel like there's an element of aspiration as well to Bond.
Well, the product placement thing goes back to Fleming. Fleming was massive on, in the books, massive on naming brands that he associated himself with. And also, like you say, aspired to. So that was very much to help create the character and the feel of who Bond is and what brands that he uses. And it's something that's translated into the films as well.
The literary technique of using brands to describe people is it's a very easy way, because people are so entwined with how much things cost and what are the best brands and things like that, that simply by saying somebody drives a certain type of car, you can save yourself two pages of like writing, because you don't need to explain how much money he earns and stuff. It's so easy to do. And with a lot of films obviously use product placement, but it can be very different. In most films, product placement tends to be whoever's paid the most money to be involved in that film. And that does happen in the Bond films. I mean, he drinks Heineken in, which one is it? Spectre. A lot. He drinks a lot of Heineken. And that's not really a very Bond thing, is it? Heineken. I don't even drink Heineken because I like nicer beers than that. So it's hardly an aspirational thing. But a lot of the time with Bond films, the brands that they work with are not chosen because somebody's paid the highest price. It's because they're the brands that they want Bond to be associated with. So it's like a part and parcel sort of deal. And the Aston Martin thing is the best example, because Aston Martin don't actually have a deal with Eon in the way that they just pay them loads of money to put the cars in. They work with them by just giving them cars. So there's no money's not changing hands. It's just there's two people that want this same thing from the brands, and it works perfectly. In the late 90s, Brosnan had BMWs. And they were paid for as part of a big marketing deal over three films. And a lot of people bought BMWs off the back of it. But BMWs aren't that expensive in comparison to Aston Martins. So everyone had them. If you go online now, the Z3, I'm trying to buy a car at the moment. And there's a Z3 down the road. And I think it was about $2,500. Aston Martins, you're not going to be able to get an Aston Martin for $2,500. but that's the thing. It wasn't... People don't associate that with Bond because it isn't aspirational. Like,
no, it's attainable.
It's attainable. But getting a BMW car is like, you can get one. You have to save up quite a bit or sell your house, but you know, you can get these cars. And that's why they're the best brands that they work with, and the places they go to and stuff are those sort of amazing ones that, you know, that do sound like you like something amazing that he could be involved with.
That's fascinating. So it seems to be the line that they have to toe is his actions can be attainable, but what he possesses and what he uses are aspirational. Yeah. So it's sort of somewhere in
but
the middle.
But I think even aspirational, even with Aston Martins, most people are probably in the back of their heads thinking, one day I can own an Aston Martin. It's not unattainable. And so even with that, even with something like, you know, having a car that's worth 250 grand or whatever, it's still, people could still think it's like, I could do that. I can do it. It's not owning a spaceship. If you owned a spaceship, people would be like, oh, God, I can't own a spaceship. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I feel like that would be quite a short Bond film as well if he had that kind of, those kind of resources.
Yeah, you know? Well, I imagine if they'd kept Brosnan on for another one, he definitely would have had a spaceship because there's nothing else he could have done.
How dare you? Yeah.
Time machine.
Oh, my goodness. But yeah, there's one thing I wanted to talk to you guys about, because another thing I think's what kind of makes these films events is the original music. Because it feels like every Bond needs to have its own original song. And some of them are just so good, aren't they? I mean, you mentioned Goldfinger, and I think all of us can instantly hear that chorus just ringing out. And there's obviously countless other examples. So I'm curious, do you guys have favourite Bond songs then?
Oof.
Go on, Brendan.
That's a tough question. We've not really discussed favourite theme songs on the podcast, have we?
Well, yours is Madonna, isn't it?
Madonna, Day, obviously. Day. Yeah.
Only one you
absolutely
like?
Absolutely not.
Wow. How does that go?
No, don't.
Again?
You don't want to do it to yourself.
Oh, no.
Yeah, maybe not then.
Yeah, again, you've got eras. It's, you know, over 60 years, you've got many different styles of music. But yeah, Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever, they're the classic ones. I do like View to a Kill. The song for View to a Kill.
Okay. That's a good one. Yeah.
And Living Daylights as well. They're quite very 80s, but I'm a fan of those, yeah. And obviously Skyfall is incredible, and it's a timeless. It's up there with Shirley Bassey. I'd love to see Adele come back and do another, actually. I think of the recent songs. I mean, Chris Cornell's You Know My Name was absolutely perfect for that film. It's an incredible song. So I can't really give you an answer on favourite. There's a lot of good ones. There's also a lot of mediocre ones.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I definitely put, if you were to twist my arm or put a gun to my head and say, choose a Bond song now, I probably would go for Goldfinger, just because that... Mm-hmm. We come back to this quite a lot in the fact that those first few Bond films, they're all sort of pulling together the elements that come together to shape the whole franchise from that point. And Goldfinger is the peak of that. It's basically all of the right points coming together to make this perfect soup of Bond ingredients. And for that reason, there's like the score, the song, the characterization, the script, everything, it just comes together perfectly in that film. And the every song, or not every song, but most songs that have come after it have looked back at that Goldfinger song and tried to in some way replicate what it did. It might not try and sound like it, but it will try and have that same sort of like build and power of that song so that it defines the character. And that song is also probably the first one that really thought in depth about matching the song to the film. So it just, the way that, how they're singing about the character and all that stuff, it just works perfectly. And again, it's a lot of the later ones, if they don't do that, you can kind of tell that it's just a song, Die Another Day. That song has got nothing to do with the film. I mean, she'd struggle to actually do a song about that film, I think anyone would, but that is a great example, because she didn't write that song for the film. It was a song she already had, so it was essentially just picking a song and sticking it on a film. Doesn't work. You've got to think about it. It's got to all meld together, and that's, you could do that with any part of the Bond series. If you pick a Bond film and one element hasn't been thought about in terms of that film, it's just, you're going to know, it's just going to be so jarring as soon as it happens.
It's funny you say about going back to Goldfinger, because what did they do after a 6-year hiatus with GoldenEye? They were like, right, we've got to try and nail this and hark back to those days. And that's what GoldenEye does as well.
Oh, yeah. It's good. It's a complete... You're taking pretty much the same type of musical artist, the same type of song, the same word.
Yep.
That's a quite a nice point to raise, because they didn't do that with Craig, which I think is a very good thing. They didn't get lazy with that. But the Chris Cornell song has the same power and sort of theme strength as those songs, but in a different style, which is good. It just shows that you've got to move with the trends and make sure that you're doing it, but you're still keeping with what people expect to hear in the time that you hear it.
Yeah, for sure, Matt. I mean, the Chris Cornell one stands out to me. That'll be of no surprise to anyone who listens to this podcast. But it, to your point, it was, yeah, I think of that. I think of Adele. I think of Diamonds Are Forever, you know, Live and Let Die. You're right, that there's a fine art to those songs, like capturing the mood of the film, but also being so good that you can hear them on the radio and quite happily listen to them and go, yeah, this is a really good tune.
It's a very tough thing to do, to make... It's the same with all the Bond stuff. It's all very difficult to get it right. But with the songs, you've got to, it's got to be good enough that people want to listen to it. If it just sounds like an old Bond song and people don't want to listen to it, you've failed. It's like Billie Eilish song. I think that's a fantastic song. It's very different than most of the Bond songs that exist, but that's one of the biggest played songs of the past few years. And there's a lot of people listening to that song. Don't even watch Bond. Don't even like it. It's just a good song that sits in its own little, you know, amazing music bubble. But it also fits perfectly with the film, which is the other half of the battle. It ties in nicely with the concept of the film. So you've ticked all these boxes with it. And that's why it takes so... I mean, they probably spend months and months trying to get the right song, testing out all these ones. We've talked about some of the other soundtracks for the films that we've done specials on. And it's amazing to hear, like, some of the people that did attempts at the films. I'm trying to remember who they are now, but Diamonds Are Forever, I think, had lots of famous singers trying out their songs on it, and they didn't use any of them, and eventually obviously went to Shirley Bassey. But it just shows that the getting the song right is so important, and they will spend ages to do it.
Yeah.
Apart from on Die Another Day.
I think, didn't Alice Cooper do Man With Golden Gun? They did a version of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Pulp did Tomorrow Never Dies, didn't they?
I'd actually like to hear those.
Yeah, they're available on the internet. You can. It is interesting. Radiohead did one for Spectre, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard about that, and I was really shocked that they didn't go with it. When you hear that versus, no offence, Sam Mendes' version, you're kind of like, but it's an obvious choice, surely. But, you know, hey, what happened, and they got an Oscar, so I'm sure they're happy with that. But there you go. I mean, that also reminds me of, talking about music, I mean, the theme, right? That's another thing, I think, that helps to make Bond so iconic and legendary. It's like Jaws, it's like Star Wars, it's like Indiana Jones, you mentioned. It's like those instant, yes, I know what that song is. As soon as you hear the first few notes, you're like, yeah, that's the Bond theme. And what I'm amazed about is when you watch any of the movies across any of the eras, it always works. Like, it always kind of gets you excited when it kicks in.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about, what was the last film we did, Brendan?
Doctor No.
Yeah, we were talking about Doctor No, and obviously that's the first film. So it's the first time that you actually heard the Bond theme played over various scenes. And I was watching it just thinking, this works so well. But if that was the first Bond film and I was seeing it for the first time, I'm not sure if it would have that same impact on me as it does now. Because, as you say, there's theme songs that are just so ingrained in culture because you instantly know what the song is. You can play the first three notes of Bond and you know instantly that it's James Bond. So in a lot of the later Bond films, you can stick it on anything and literally anything. Is it View to Kill where he's just walking around a bedroom?
Yeah. And they stick it on. There's a lot where they just overuse it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It can just be. I think they do it in Doctor No, don't they? He's just walking through an airport.
Yeah, he's got walking through the airport,
and he's not doing anything. And they're playing the music, and suddenly it becomes. You think, oh, this is good, great scene. If you took that off, it'd just be a man walking through an airport.
Well,
but if you look, a good example is Never Say Never Again. Have you seen that one? The one that isn't part of canon. It's a remake of Thunderball with Sean Connery.
I think I have actually. Yeah, that was probably on telly a long time ago.
Well, that one is it wasn't made by Eon. It was made by Warner Brothers, and so they didn't have the rights to the music. So it's a Bond film without Bond music. And if you watch that, I think somebody edited it with the Bond music on to show what it was like. But you watch that, and you instantly go, "God, this could really do with the Bond music." A lot of it has some weird like.
It's
like
just
80s jive guitar.
Yeah, it's 80s style. But yeah, there is a YouTube clip of the opening five minutes with Bond music on, and it does elevate it. It is instantly more watchable and more interesting. So the music is doing a lot of heavy lifting across the whole franchise, really. Mm. It's sort of notching it up to the next gear.
It's an audio cue. It's like Pavlov's dogs. Yeah. You hear that music and you suddenly go, right, this scene is action. I'm going to enjoy the action in this scene. And regardless of what it is, it's very clever.
My favourite use of that theme, though, is at the end of Casino Royale. They'd not used the theme at all throughout that film. And then right at the end, and he hadn't said Bond, James Bond either. And so David Arnold put in that right at the end. A great composer, David Arnold, really understands the music of Bond. But yeah, he goes Bond, James Bond, and it kicks in, and instantly the Pavlovian response in the audience is, oh, amazing.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Instant applause. Like, yeah, you've got us. That could be an interesting experiment, actually. Just start inserting the James Bond theme just when doing stuff around the house. See if it makes it more exciting.
That was the best toast I ever had.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's great. I'm going to start doing that. It's also made my intro music incredibly easy for this episode. There you go. Oh, man. I'm wondering then, for you guys, do you have a favourite Bond film? I wonder, because we've talked about favourite Bonds, favourite, you know, characters and eras, but is there any one movie that you're like, yeah, this is head and shoulders above everything else? And again, I think this is your favourite. It doesn't have to be the best critically or whatever. It's just the one that you go, yeah, that's my favourite one. I'll stick that on any time.
Go on, Wheatley, you go first.
Well, mine's always obvious, and it is the best one, but it's also my favourite. And I don't know if my favourite has changed over time, and I think it probably will do as time goes on, but I always come back to Goldfinger just because no matter how many times I watch all of the Bond films and I watch one and think, oh, this is better than I thought, or this is not as good as I thought, Goldfinger's never changed. Every time I watch it, I go, amazing, this is just perfect. And I think it's probably the reason why I stuck with it when I was younger as well. I think Goldfinger was the one that it was probably on every Sunday, all these different Bond films, all the Roger Moore ones. But I think Goldfinger's the one that really made me stick with it.
Okay. I'm going to probably be really boring and agree with...
this doesn't happen.
This never happens. We never agree. But what a... what?
I thought you were going to say Tomorrow Never Dies, but, you know.
Absolutely not.
Don't tempt him.
But my top three are definitely interchangeable. It's not as clear cut as Wheatley's choice. Goldfinger is definitely my favourite and the best. I don't think it's going to change that it's the best. I can acknowledge that it's probably the best. But from Russia with Love and Dr. No as well, the first three actually, they should have just stopped after 1964. Don't bother with the rest. But they're all interchangeable, depending on, and that's the beauty of Bond, isn't it? There's a Bond for whatever mood you're in, really. But from Russia with Love, I just like that it, despite what I said earlier about not liking the pace when I was younger, now the pacing is exactly what I love about it. It's really slow.
Mm. What, now you're getting older. your favourite is going to be Octopussy in about 10 years.
Yeah, when I'm making quiches.
Yeah.
I'm only 27 and I can kind of identify with that already.
What's your favourite? Do you have a favourite?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm sort of a sucker for this newer era. I probably would just go basic answer, but Casino Royale was just such a huge thing when I saw that in cinema, because unlike you, I sort of enjoyed the Pierce Brosnan, but was like, yeah, these are sort of also a bit kind of silly in places, and it's fine. And then I saw that film, and I'm sort of that right generation where it was like, oh, this is brilliant. Yeah. This is absolutely spot on. But to your point, though, I do think about sort of a lot of the Sean Connery stuff. Goldfinger, I think, is an absolute standout. You're right. It's just, yeah, if you're going to say, like, to somebody, what's a quintessential Bond film? That's one you definitely, I would definitely show somebody and say, yeah, check this out. This has got everything in it.
Yeah, we've gone through this a bit before. We have a listing of our favorite ones, and every time we do a review on the podcast, we revise the list to work out where all these different films are. But I think Casino Royale is, I think it must be second at the moment behind Goldfinger.
Haven't done Goldfinger.
Yeah, of course. I'm just getting ahead of it now. Definitely going to be number one. But the ones that do well, I think, and Casino Royale is a good example of this, is a film that sits on its own as a good film.
Yeah.
That you don't need any other films to make it good. And Casino Royale is perfect to that. But if you were to watch Skyfall, maybe it would be okay. But out of context, it's probably not anywhere near as good as Casino Royale, because there's a lot of elements that you need to understand. There's a lot of baggage in that film. Whereas Casino Royale, it's just so clean and smooth, and you can just watch it every time and just enjoy it without finding any flaws in it.
Yeah, yeah. But then by the time you get to Spectre, it's a whole mess.
If you get to Spectre.
Yeah, I think to your point, that's something that, I don't know, in my opinion, what makes a good Bond film is it's something that's standalone. And you think that kind of goes in hand with the nature of the character, right? That he's a spy that goes on adventures. So inherently, if you're going to make one of these movies, you'd think you'd want them to stand out. And to come back to something you guys said earlier, I agree with you in that when they start doing this thing of trying to unpack the character and give him an origin story and make Blofeld his half-brother, that's when it kind of starts to fall apart and you're like, we don't like this. this doesn't
The problem with that is you really didn't need it. It's enough. Like, being Blofeld, that's enough. Why are they trying to retro sort of fit
absolutely
the story going back?
It's a very modern story arc way of going about things, and they've never done it before. I'm kind of hoping that when they do the next Bond, they're going to go back to the idea of individual films instead of this big story arc, because they made so many mistakes in that story arc that like normal people probably can overlook it, but if you're really into Bond, you just can't overlook them. And every time I rewatch it, I see more of them. I think, why have they brought this up? You just don't need it. You could have shaved off 45 minutes of this film and not gone through this weird detail.
Well, to that point, I think, you know, Quantum of Solace exists because of that, and that's why that film is the way it is, because they were kind of, my understanding is they were in between the rights of getting Spectre or something, and so they had to kind of just make something up.
And so
like when you then watch Spectre later on, it's like that entire film is just cancelled out because it was just a warm-up act, and you're like, well,
oh, there's so
if you'd have done something else, if you'd just said, let's send him off on a different adventure,
they could have, that would have been so simple. In Spectre, they didn't have to draw attention to any of the previous films. They could have just carried on, and you can talk about you didn't have to tie in the fact that Spectre had caused the previous two films. That's the biggest problem in Spectre. Because they never planned that in the first place. If you look at the MCU, if they hadn't have planned out the MCU, they just started adding bits and pieces on as they went along, and then saying, actually, Iron Man, that suit that you've got, I made that. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Never mentioned that before. You can't retcon these story arcs without losing a certain level of like quality from them. But the problem I have is that they didn't need to. Mm. They didn't need to say that. Yeah. It wouldn't have made it any worse.
Yeah. And then it left a difficult task with No Time to Die, where they're having to sort of patch things up and go, right, okay, we need to sort of rectify what's happened. So yeah, standalone next, please. Just a nice on its own would be good.
Yeah. I'd say something else I think that works when it's standalone, and that we've kind of talked about a little bit, but that's, I think, villains and their accompanying henchmen. Mm. That's another thing I think that makes Bond so much fun to watch, is each one usually comes with a interesting quirk or, you know, a sort of, I don't know, trait or something. Do you guys have any favourite villains?
Loads. Loads. Yeah, the villains are probably my favourite bit of it. I'd say my favourite villain, Goldfinger, but also Scaramanga. I'll go Scaramanga to mix it up a bit.
I was going to go Scaramanga. You can't...
You can have Goldfinger.
You can have the same answer. That's fine. Yeah,
Scaramanga.
That's fine. There's no wrong
I quite like answers. 006 in GoldenEye.
Oh, yeah, he's... Yeah, I that's think, good.
You know, perfectly cast as well. Sean Bean's fantastic. And just the whole, you know, betrayal, double agent. It's very good. Spoiler alert, by the way. Sorry.
spoiler for all of these movies. Also, that film's responsible for one of my favourite memes, which is Buying a Pint. It's so bizarre. Like, I encourage people to go and look it up on YouTube. It's 5 seconds. It's one of the strangest line readings you'll ever see, but it's brilliant.
Closing time, James. No score.
Buy me a pint.
But no, I like that. That's good. And I guess, again, that's the other thing about the Bond and about, like you say, when they're standalone films, is you can have fun with that, you know, as a writer. You know, you can come up with colourful characters, and that sort of becomes a bit of a trope, I feel, with some of the films after a while. They have their base, and they have their, you know, they have their sort of end of the world plot.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of fun, because, again, you get to see Bond run around and do what he does best. Yeah.
Well, there's a certain level of these Bond films in that those tropes, you kind of want them. Because
exactly.
What is it? I can't remember the analogy. Some old American president's axe. If you take out something from it, if you take the handle away from it, and you've got the head of the axe, it's still the same axe. But then you take the head off, and then put another head on. Is it the same axe? So if you've got this film, this Bond series, and you keep taking bits out and then replacing it with something else, and then you haven't got the same Bond film, it's not Bond anymore. And that's consistency in the Bond films is what people like in it. People like the reassurance of things being what they know, but they want it just slightly different. That's the key with most sort of stories that exist in the world, isn't it? They want the same but slightly different. And it's the same with the baddies. You always want the baddie to be slightly ridiculous. You don't want just a normal bloke who is actually could kill Bond. You want somebody ridiculous who's going to do something stupid. So obviously you can't kill Bond. And that's happened in every single one. Even in the Craig era, they're still ridiculous baddies. Rami Malek's still like, what is he doing? Why is he... the sheer confusing process he's gone through to get to what he's doing today is very, very strange. Like if it was a normal guy, if you were just a head of a mob and you wanted to kill Bond in the real world, you just kill him.
Your favorite Goldfinger. He's playing golf with him. He's just
won't
kill him.
But that's what you want. That's the baddies in Bond are so important. And the best ones, I think, the Goldfinger and Scaramanga's and Trevelyan's a good example as well, is where it's about him and another man. It's not about big armies trying to get him. And that's why the Blofeld works, and it's the biggest trope in Bond, and that's why Austin Powers follows it. But it's still not a very... It's still a ridiculous... He's a pantomime villain, basically. And that works for that era. And that era that we're talking about, it's also a very childlike era. It's like a kid's film, where kids like seeing big volcanoes, and they like seeing flying little mini helicopters and stuff like that, and a boss, a baddie that's got big facial scars and a cat. It's all very pantomime.
Well, it was written by Roald Dahl. What are you expecting?
Well, that one was, but Scaramanga. There's some pretty copycat baddies that Moore had as well. Drax and... Mm. Who's the other guy with the base underwater? I can't remember his name, but from Spy Love Me. But they
Stromberg.
Are just they're all the same. They're all the same. It's a weird boss that has a massive base, loads of money, an army, sharks, all these different things. And I think for me in those films, the baddies are the worst part. It's the Scaramanga's an amazing baddie because it's just him against Bond.
Yeah.
And same with Goldfinger, which is mano el mano. That's what the golf thing is so good. Sorry, but I don't think Daniel Craig ever has a good baddie,
Silver.
Does he? I can't think
Silver's
of one.
Good.
Silver's good, actually, yes. Well, he's good for half of the film. And then when he starts dressing up as a policeman and sliding down tube escalators, he loses a little bit of credibility.
I like Le Chiffre. He's good.
Oh, he's very good. I forgot about Le Chiffre. Yeah, he has got a couple of good ones. Yeah.
But when they start to focus on Blofeld, that's where it's like, okay, right.
Yeah.
There's a reason we've not listed him as our favourite. You know, he's nowhere near. They've done him too much. He was far more imposing when you didn't see him on screen for the. It was just his voice, and you saw the stroking of the cat, and that.
Should have done that for five films.
Yeah, they shouldn't have showed him so quickly. Yeah.
Yeah, that could have been better. And I always thought it was a bit of a waste of Christoph Waltz as an actor. He doesn't sort of get a lot to do with the role.
No. And the fact that he's meant to be his brother is just the strangest concept ever. And as soon as he says that, as soon as you find out, you suddenly go, oh, God. So there's that. So he's not just a baddie. He's got a load of mental issues around this brother thing. Oh, okay, don't care. Yeah.
Whereas if it was just he wants to take over the world because he's power mad. Yeah, I'm on board. Yeah.
Well, that's the beauty, the simplicity of the best Bond films is that is the simplicity. Mm. You want somebody who is evil. You don't want them to redeem themselves in any way. It's an evil person. Bond's a good person. Go and get it. Nowadays, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. I suppose like you look at Silver, he's very complicated. Even Trevelyan. He's quite nuanced as well. I much prefer the really obvious baddies that just want to kill people or steal things.
Like Gustav Graves in Die Another Day.
I don't even remember what he was trying to do.
He built a big diamond thing in the sky, hadn't he?
And wasn't there the guy that had diamonds in his face as well? That was another thing.
he's the most convoluted bad in the world. But the problem with that one is he probably could have got away with it if he was just a madman who was doing these things. But they also tried to add layers of humanity to him where you try to understand his reasoning behind doing it. Don't care, mate. Don't care. Just carry on.
To that point, obviously, I don't want to go too heavy on spoilers because it's still in the cinemas at this time. And by the time this comes out, I thought most people would have seen it, but still. Can you explain to me what Rami Malek's villain was all about in the film? Because I've seen it. I loved the movie. I was really confused by what his motivations were, though. I didn't get it. I don't know if I missed something.
He's the most confusing character in it.
Blofeld would have killed him ages ago. So I don't you know, he wouldn't even be a thing. And yet he's built this garden, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I got. I was like, oh, he's enthusiastic about horticulture. Yeah. Okay. And what's this got to do with blowing up the world?
Well, I think I said this on the podcast. I think they didn't really put a lot of thought or effort into Rami Malek's character because they didn't want him to be that important in it. I think it's all about Craig. It's his last film. It's all about tying up all the Bond loose ends. So really you don't want, and I'm glad they didn't turn it into some sort of, I don't know, his nephew or something like that.
I'm your cousin three times removed.
I just didn't really care about him, but it didn't matter because it wasn't about him anyway. He was just an object that was doing stuff, but
I
enjoyed Blofeld in No Time to Die though. He was.
They did him well. They did him well. That was my biggest fear.
Quite a decent redemption they've done there. The entrance was fantastic, because it went on for so long.
That's true. It reminded me of that bit in The Holy Grail where John Cleese is coming over the hill and it just keeps happening. I was looking at my watch at one point, like, that's a really long hallway. There's also a lot of gesturing in that scene. Again, without spoiling it for anybody, that took me out of the film a little bit, but still thought it was funny. And you're right. Yeah, definitely a nice moment for Christoph Waltz to do something fun with the character.
Yeah, I think the Christoph Waltz Blofeld stuff in Spectre really soured my taste of Bond for a while. And the lead up to No Time to Die, I was saying to these guys, I'm not excited about it because I'm fairly certain. I'm basically going in expecting a really stupid film about Blofeld. So when I saw how they'd done him in that film, I was very pleased because I thought, well, they've actually tied it up nicely and they've not made any stupid errors. He didn't mention, like, I'm not going to get too much depth, but they don't talk about him being his brother very much. So that was a good thing.
Yeah, definitely a fair bit of retconning, but effective. Yeah. Effective. Yeah. And again, at time of recording, it is out. And I think by the time I put this out, it should probably still be in cinemas. So if someone's listening and they haven't, go see it. Why not? I think it's a good send off for the character. It's a nice way for him to wrap up the story. And I think it does a pretty good job of tying up some very messy continuity.
Yeah. Well, I went with my mum and dad, and my mum and dad don't like anything good. every time they say, oh, we're going to see this tonight, it'll be like the worst film that's out at the moment. So I took them and I said, look, just you know, don't take it too seriously, just, you know, enjoy yourself. I bought you ice and popcorn. They absolutely loved it. And I think they've done a really good job of it in that they have managed to not focus on one demographic or one group. So it's not just for the fans, it's not just for the general people, like Die Another Day. Die Another Day was not for the fans. Die Another Day was, if we do this, more people will watch it. And they did. It made more money than any other Bond film. But the fans didn't like it. And that's the balance you've got to get.
I'd say one thing I thought it did very well, and I'd love to talk a bit more about this, is I think it helped to kind of evolve the Bond girl a bit more. In this story, like, she's got a lot more to do and has a much bigger arc, and that helps that she's a carryover from a previous film. But I wonder what you guys make of that, because that's another thing that's a big part of the Bond movies and has definitely changed over the last 6 years.
Well, it had to. I mean, if you watch a Connery film, it's absolutely ridiculous how women are treated and portrayed. Very problematic. Mm-hmm. My issue with No Time to Die and the character of Madeline is I don't care about that relationship, because I don't see them enjoying each other's company at all.
Yeah.
Like, I've not seen all this, oh, we're really in love. Show me, because I've not seen it. So my issue with that is that I didn't care about the relationship. I can see what they're trying to do, but for me, I just didn't buy it. In terms of Bond women that they did well, I thought Lashana Lynch was fantastic. And what's the...
Anna de
Armas. That scene was excellent in Cuba. So they're definitely portraying and treating women definitely for the better. I hope that continues. Oh, it will continue. Yeah, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's always a difficult one with Bond, because the history of the female leads in Bond films has been a very murky past, really. And there's been some good high points, but they've never really ever got it right, ever, apart from Vesper Lynd, I think. So up until the Daniel Craig era, the Bond women were really a prop as part of the film that you just put in there. Because you expected it the same way you expected stunts and the same way you expected amazingly nice locations. And we talked a bit the other day about the original Bond girls that were in, like, Dr. No and From Russia with Love. And when they talked about getting these ladies into the films, they didn't talk of them about them like act. They didn't care if they're actors. They just had no interest in them. If they could act, they weren't interested. They were looking purely for the most amazing looking women they could find to go on to be shown on screen, so that when people watched it, they'd go, amazing, that person's not real, which obviously can't do that anymore. It's a ridiculous concept. But in the more modern ones, I think Vespeland was probably the only one they've ever got right, because she was a really well-rounded character. She had a chemistry with Bond. She had lots of depth to her character, and she had a great ending. And she ended up, I know she dies at the end of it, but she ended on a high, that character did, because she didn't just turn into a useless woman, which is what they normally turn out to be at the end of Bond films. And I do think that the new one, Ana de Armas is great, doesn't really get used very much. She would have been amazing if she was had a much bigger role in that. What's the name of the main one?
Madeline
Swan, yeah. I just don't think she's needed in the way that she's used, which is a bit of a shame, because they've obviously put a lot of effort into No Time to Die to really sort of adjust the way that Bond women are used in the films, and the amount they're used and how they interact with Bond. But I still don't think I think they got it right with Casino Royale, and I just don't think they've got it all right with No Time to Die.
It's amazing, as we're doing the podcast and we're doing each film and each actor that's played a Bond woman, and they start off, you're like, yeah, this character is well-rounded, okay, let's see, and they all just nosedive in the final third of each film. And it's a pattern that continues time and time and time again. And yet these actors that are playing them, they're saying, oh, I'm happy to play a Bond girl that's got something different. You know, she's strong. Yeah. She's like, yeah, she is, to a point.
There's Mark O'Connell, who's a Bond writer. He talks quite a lot about every time there's a Bond premiere, there's always a Bond woman stood on the red carpet saying exactly the same thing about how that she picked the script because it was a counterpart to Bond and it was a really strong, powerful female presence. And if you look at any of those films that they've said that about, they're not, because they may start that way and they may have a fight with Bond at the start, and then the shoots a gun and saves Bond. By the end of it, they're in bikinis, they're useless, screaming, and Bond has to save them, which is just, that happens all the way up to Brosnan's.
Yeah, Dying of the Day, where Rosamund Pike, right at the end, just costume change, just because. Yeah, and it's like...
into a bra, isn't it?
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's useless. And the Jinx, the Halle Berry character, who is basically a CIA agent who's meant to be Bond's CIA like version in the US, she starts off as being like Bond. She's doing the same stuff as Bond. By the end of it, she's needs to be saved again, and she's absolutely useless. She does kill someone at the end, but it's not very good.
It's like she forgets all of her training just because she has to in that final third, otherwise Bond can't be the hero. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, again, it's something that, I mean, to your guys' point, it does seem to be changing for the better in this newer era. And hopefully moving forward, it will continue to improve, which, and it leads me on to something I'm really curious about from your guys' point of view. I mean, where do you see the franchise going moving forward? Because this is Craig's last film. He's wrapped it up. I think Amazon's bought it now. Is that right?
Amazon.
So where do you guys think where it's going now?
Go on, BJ.
I don't know. That's the thing. There's so many places they could take it. They could do a full MCU style across the board, you know, TV shows, films. But I think with Barbara Broccoli still on board producing, I think that won't happen. I think the Broccoli family have been integral to the way Bond is portrayed, the way Bond is made, and the way it's distributed. So I think we'll stick to films, just standalone films. But I mean, they could do a one set in the 60s. So they could do a period piece if they wanted to. They could do a full, I mean, I would imagine they're going to do a reboot of some form, but they could do really old Bond. They kind of did that on No Time to Die, which is a shame, because I'm still pinning my hopes on Pierce Brosnan making a comeback, playing like Logan style Bond. But who knows? It's certainly exciting to see who they announce next year.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there'll be a big change. With the end of the Brosnan era, which wasn't that long ago, and the Craig era, they can't go down either of those routes. They can't do a Craig story arc again in the same way. It'll just be boring. People won't watch it. They can't do a Brosnan style thing because people aren't into that sort of ridiculous pantomime action anymore. So they're going to have to do something different. And I agree with Brendan. I think it's very likely that they'll go period just because it's never been done before. And it's on trend. Like if you had a period Bond, people would love it. People would love the way it looked. People would love the music and it would just do really well. It might just be a one-off and they've never done that before, but it's definitely going to be a big shift in how we look at Bond, I think.
Hmm. And do you think that will come as well in the form of casting? Because it feels like whenever you talk about it, I mean, before Craig had officially retired from Bond, you know, there's always rumours floating around about who the next one's going to be. And there's discussions of maybe they'll change the race, maybe they'll change the gender and so on and so forth. I mean, what do you guys think is the future of James Bond in that regard in casting?
I think it'll be a while until they... I think the gender discussion is something that is going to go on for a while, but I don't think that'll happen anytime soon. And Barbara Broccoli has said that Bond is a man and will stay as a man. And Craig said a good thing. I think it was Craig who said that it's not an argument about whether there should be a female Bond. It's why aren't we writing a character who's as good as Bond for women? And I think that's a good argument. There's no reason why you just, you know, unless there was a clear reason why you do it, you know, you don't just do it for the sake of it. Obviously, the sort of where Bond comes from is pretty irrelevant these days and what race Bond is. So, yeah, I mean, that's very likely that could happen. It's definitely don't think there's any objections to that in the world. So, I think the difficult thing will be the overall cast of the film, because one of the things we talked about is Dame Judi Dench. They kept Dame Judi Dench on from the Brosnan era into the Craig era because that consistency is something you need. You need to have something that's grounding Bond into the previous Bond so that it's not jarring. If you suddenly just change everything and put a completely new Bond in, people watch it and go, "Ooh, hold on, I'm not used to this." You need something where people go, oh, it's okay. James, Judi Dench is there. I'm all right. So I know where I am now. So that's going to be a big one. I have a feeling, unless they do go period, that they will keep the key players like Fiennes and Moneypenny and the rest of them. I think they're young. Most of them are really young, so they'd fit in with it really nicely. But you still and everyone loves all those characters as well. If they kept them, it would be fantastic. So yeah, I'd be surprised if they started completely fresh. But obviously, if they went to the 60s, you'd have to.
I think if they went to the 60s, you could argue that the era and the music is the sort of the crossover where you can you're pulling that across rather than an actor that's played that role before. You've got it's Bond has been in the 60s, the music is 60s, you know, you've got that's your continuity there. In terms of casting the next Bond, I think as long as it's the right person for the role, I trust Barbara Broccoli to do the right thing. It doesn't matter.
She knows what she's doing.
She knows what she's doing. She'll pick the right person. The biggest concern is probably the age of the person. That's you know, where do you go? Do you go 20s or 30s, or do you start in the 40s? I mean, it depends how long they see the tenure of the next Bond actor. But a period piece could actually be the way, like a one-off would be a good sort of reset to while they're going away thinking about the next step. They could just do this one-off period, would be quite interesting to do that. But yeah, in terms of the supporting cast, how No Time to Die ended, I don't think you can keep them on. That's my concern. I want them to stay on. Don't get me wrong. I think they're great, but I don't know if you can.
They'll forget it. They'll just move on and forget that last bit.
maybe. But I like what you guys are saying there. I think that could be interesting. I for one would love to see a period piece from Bond. I think like a one-off, like you said, could be really fun, and it's different. And I guess that's the key, yeah. Right? Is what we were saying earlier, is if you're going to make the next series work, it's got to be different. Yeah. And as you say, they clearly they've got the finger on the pulse and they're keeping an eye out. And yeah, I'm always excited. I'm always excited to hear who will be the next person. I mean, I never really care that much. I'm not one of these people that gets any.
You didn't set up a website about Daniel Craig.
It happens. Yeah, that's the thing that cracks me up, right? I remember that. I remember the people being like, "Oh, but he's blonde." It's like, what? Yeah. What are you talking about? Like, he's you know, you look him up on IMDb and you go, "Oh, he's an established actor. Just give him a go. See what he's like." And he was perfect for the role.
Yeah, so. But it was majority of people who hadn't seen his career. They were just angry. And the website's still right. up as well.
Of course it is.
So yeah. they'll get their day next year, and then they can moan about the next person.
I mean, this is something we talk about in nearly every episode, is that there's always some corner of the fandom which is very pretentious and protective, and I just kind of brush them aside, if I'm being honest. Yeah. I don't care. But I wonder, for you guys, is there anything else you want to talk about with Bond, or any sort of key things that you think are really just important to you or you love about it?
I don't know. I think for me, I often talk about this in that the reason that I think Bond is so good is that it's almost like following the history of popular culture. To follow Bond, if you can take any Bond at any point, you can kind of understand the culture of that period of time. And there's no other series that's ever done that, I don't think. It's basically followed the whole history of cinema through how it's all made, all of the... You see some quite interesting bits about the earlier Bond films and how they were filmed and how they have issues translating that to modern cameras and things like that. But a lot of the stuff that happens in Bond is at the forefront of how those things are done. So you look at some of the ways that they did the title sequences of Bond, the opening credit sequences. They were revolutionary when they first came around. The way that Morris Binder used to pull together these title sequences, they were like new ways of using film to do stuff. And that's across the board of Bond. They're always trying to do that. We did do Casino Royale, but that's the only one we've done of Craig so far. So I can't remember if there's anything in Craig films that's akin to that. But they definitely, they find ways to do things better. And I think following the Bond series, you can see that because you sort of follow that journey as you go along. They don't stick to one format, but they always have a general theme of how they do it.
Underwater filming in Thunderball as well. That was something they wanted to try out. They're like, we've got this technology. Let's make it. Yeah. Maybe it's too much underwater, but you know,
an hour and a half.
but they're not afraid to sort of embrace that new technology that's moving forward. And that's what I think the relevant, keeping themselves relevant is what is part of the charm of Bond. It is like a little time capsule as well. Like you say, you can go back and you watch a 60s one and go, okay, that's what life was like then. And that's the world Bond sort of running around in. And
But speaking about the text that's keeping stuff modern, that's one thing I actually would like to see in the old style if they went back and did a period piece, because I think technology has slightly ruined a lot of the newer ones, because like you can do anything. They just go and see Q and go, Q, can you find me all of these people and log into their bank details and all this stuff? And like, yep, sure, just give me 2 minutes. In the old Q, we used to go to him and say, can you give me a bomb that's smaller than this? And he'd go, oh yes, don't you worry. And that's all he could do. Here's a attaché case with a knife in it. Oh, amazing. That's fantastic. But yeah, nowadays, all of the... They've pretty much covered everything. Like, they've done social media.
Yeah. Tomorrow Never Dies, didn't they? So they've pretty much done media.
Like, the Craig ones, they've really ticked off a lot of the sort of modern thing, the modern tropes that you can't redo. Yeah. So he's got that whole sort of surveillance system around the world, Inspector. Yeah. Can't do that now because it would be exactly the same.
Nanotech.
Done. Can't do that again. What was the one? What was Silver doing? He had some tech.
It was kind of like hacking and, yeah, it was a lot of that.
That was a revenge one, wasn't it? So maybe not so much. Mm. But, yeah, there's like, it's very limited what you can do. And they really struggle, I think, to come up with concepts that work. In the olden days of Bond, it was easy.
Giant lasers.
You had Russians. You had Russians. You had a common enemy and you could just do films about trying to take down the Russians. Yeah. As soon as that was all over, it's all like in the 90s, was not enough. It's all about the
oil, isn't it?
It's all about the oil, which was obviously a big thing at the time. And then the media in Tomorrow Never Dies, and then Die Laser. What was that about? Sun
Laser.
Was it just about laser?
Is that a giant
laser's never been on.
They went backwards. Yeah,
lasers have never been on trend. They're useless.
That's a note. That's a free note for you there, Barbara Broccoli, if you're listening.
No more lasers.
It's dumb lasers.
But I think the it's M that says it in No Time to Die, isn't it? That we can't see the common enemy now. You know, they're behind a computer screen, and that's all well and good, but it doesn't make for interesting viewing.
No, it's different, isn't it?
Yeah. I think to your point, it's almost like what Skyfall started to address a little bit of, do we need people running around doing this? It's sort of commenting on how arcane it is, but then, of course, it ends up being useful in the end. Yeah. But then, like, to your point, maybe that's the clue then. It's like, we'll need to go backwards because, like you say, moving forward, it's not going to be very entertaining if next Bond villain is some 12-year-old kid on a laptop.
And he's got an app. Yeah. He just presses a button. It's done.
Yeah.
Well, that's on a simpler level as well. One thing that always annoys me about movies these days, and I watch a lot of old films, it's things like mobile phones and social media, because it's so difficult to write any sort of script or have any sort of cohesive storyline with mobile phones and social media, because anything you do, you just go, well, why wouldn't you have just done that? And they would know.
Yeah.
Whereas you look at the old ones and they go, I can't get to a phone. I can't tell people that I'm going to get murdered. Yeah. That way, if it's set now, you just go, I'm just about to be murdered. Oh, right.
Well, it's funny you say that. You know, Home Alone is coming out to Disney Plus. Set modern day. And I'm just thinking, right, can't he just
text him from the, from the airport.
We're text him, back. Do a TikTok video. It's just...
Maybe his phone's broken in it or something.
The whole network's down. How convenient.
Yeah, the network's down.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Or he just sit and play Halo all for 3 days.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a problem.
No, you'd
they'd have like Alexa cameras all around the house anyway, so they'd know if they were being burgled.
When he was when they're on the way back, he could have just texted him, couldn't he? Said, "Oh, you've forgotten. Forgotten me." Oh, okay, right.
So that's the difficulty.
That's gonna be quite an exciting film, isn't it? They don't even get to the airport.
Home Alone for an hour.
Oh my goodness. So I think we're all in agreement then. Yeah, it sounds like if this franchise wants to continue, which of course it will. I mean, Amazon's not going to buy it for nothing. Who knows? Maybe going backwards, maybe simplifying it, having it as a bit of a throwback. Mm. It would definitely tap into the nostalgia, I think, of what makes Bond so great. To your point earlier, it's like that's something that might sort of get a lot more people on board, because A, it would make, you know, people like us who are familiar with it go, oh, this is like a nice throwback, and B, it might be something completely different to a new generation. Yeah. They'll go, oh, what's this? And it might grab their attention.
And they're going to want to do it. I mean, Amazon have just bought it. Amazon want to make a lot of money. Not going to be waiting 6 years to make the next Bond film. They're going to be saying, look, you've got a lot of money to do this as soon as possible. I mean, I imagine that Barbara and Michael G. Wilson probably will push them back and say, we need time to do this, but they're not going to get loads of time. So, you can't follow up Craig very quickly with something very similar. It's going to have to be able to make these announcements and go, we've got this person in and we're going to do this. And people be like, wow, that's phenomenal. They're going to do that. If they just go, oh, we've got somebody in who's slightly like Craig and we're going to make something very similar to what we've just done with Craig, people would be like, right, okay, not interested in this anymore.
Right. Well, there you go. So, yeah, who knows? I'm really curious to see what happens with this franchise. But I just want to say thanks so much, guys, for coming on. This has been a really, really interesting conversation. And I mean, where can the good people find you then? Because you guys do this as well. You've got your own podcast, and I'd love for you to go and plug it. If people want to hear more about James Bond, they want to go even more in depth with you, where can they do that?
Well, the easiest way is Brendan always does the social handles. I always do the email address.
At James Bond A to Z. So that's on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Yeah. And if you go onto one of those, you'll be able to, it will link you through to all the different places that you can download the podcast from. And you can get it from pretty much anywhere. It's A to Z, James Bond A to Z, Apple, so, Spotify. So yeah, pretty easy to find.
Brilliant. Well, thanks. And of course, I'll be putting links into all of that in the show notes for people. But I just want to say, Tom, Brendan, thanks
for having
so
us.
Much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
And there we have it. Another fantastic episode recorded. Thank you so much to both Tom and Brendan for coming onto the podcast and sharing your love of all things James Bond with us. I hope you guys listening really enjoyed that episode. Definitely go and give their podcast a follow. That's the James Bond A to Z podcast. I've put links in the show notes for you where you can go and find them, their individual social media accounts, all of that good stuff. Go and give them a follow. Go give them a listen. You will not regret it. I, of course, want to give a big thank you, as always, to the resident artist, Alex, who designs the logo for the podcast. If you like what you see in our artwork and our banners, make sure you use the links that are in the description for him to commission him for your very own artwork as well. And, of course, a big thank you to you, dear listener, for checking out this podcast. If you liked what you heard, then reach out to me. Let me know what you thought. I'd love to hear from you. You can find my social media links and my email in the show notes of this podcast. Don't hesitate to reach out. Any and all feedback is welcome. I'm also looking for guest spots all the time. So if you're listening and you think you might have a topic that you could bring to the show, I'm always open to that. So you can reach out and message me. And who knows, you could have your very own episode of Fundamentals. And if you'd like to go that one step further and help to promote the podcast, the best ways to do that, number one is tell someone that you like the podcast. Word of mouth is invaluable. You can also share on social media. If you do that, be sure to tell me, because I would like to give you a shout out on the podcast. And the final one is to go and give me a lovely 5-star review on your favorite podcatcher. If you do that, then again, reach out to me, because I'd love to give you a shout out. I'd love to thank you for supporting the podcast. That's it from me. I'll be back again in a few weeks' time with a completely different guest on a completely different subject. So until then, stay tuned and stay safe.